Great. Okay, everyone. Good evening. Welcome to Bevis Marcus Synagogue. My name is Shlomo Morris. I'm the rabbi here, and it is my great pleasure to welcome all of you to this evening's lecture, the first in our summer-long lecture series, the famous and infamous of Anglo-Jewry. By way of introduction to tonight's lecture, we're going to be speaking about three individuals over the course of this series. Daniel Mendoza, some of you I believe are related to. We'll be talking about Sir Moses Montefiore and Benjamin Disraeli. Now, the thing that connects all three of these individuals together are several things, as we'll see, but one of the things that connects them is that they all spent at least part of their childhoods here. I mean, in this building, right, at Bevis Marcus Synagogue. They all were part of this community, at least at some point of their life, some of them throughout their entire lives. And as a result, each of these figures, they're all world famous, right? These were all figures that certainly became nationally well-known, if not world-renowned. And as a result, within the materials of the synagogue that have been produced over the years, they often talk about the three sons of Bevis Marcus and speak about these individuals. And I always kind of felt uncomfortable with that kind of presentation of the community, because obviously each of these individuals have different life stories, and you know, they may or may not reflect the values of Bevis Marcus Synagogue. And in that way, it seemed a little bit just kind of, I don't know, commercial to try and raise our profile by associating ourselves with these famous people just because they were famous. But what I found in reading more about them over the past 2 years and doing research into their lives is that I actually think they are really important figures from not just a historic pride of, you know, oh, look at famous Jews type of story, but actually that they are important in a really meaningful way, because they help us answer a question, or at least help us to ask a question about what does it mean to be a Jew. And I say that because I think their stories reflect different paths that Anglo-Jews have taken, or different ways that Anglo-Jews have answered that question. And in that way, actually reflecting on their lives is deeply informative about our own identities. And understanding, you know, kind of the struggles and challenges and opportunities that Anglo-Jews have faced over the centuries. And then in a lot of ways, it's almost ironic that these three figures, each who become super famous, each who grew up in Bevis Marcus, could actually be taken as models or as kind of, I don't want to say, you know, paradigms, but in a sense, paradigms of Anglo-Jews. And in that way, I think they're really interesting to think about. And are worthwhile, and in that sense, actually, are good figures to be thinking about in the context of the synagogue. And when we talk about the history of this historic community, I actually think that it actually is worthwhile to talk about these three figures because they do tell this story beyond just, you know, trying to look at our glorious history, right? And so I think that actually it is something which is really important. And so we're going to use this series to reflect on these different paths. One of the ways I want to also think about them, and we'll really maybe reflect on it at the end of each lecture, is that when we talk about, you know, sons in Judaism, to me, what comes up is the Haggadah, right? Where we talk about the four sons, right? You have the wise son, and the wicked son, and the simple son, and the son that doesn't know how to ask. And so one of the things that I've been finding that paradigm helpful in trying to think about, you know, who do these different sons represent? You know, if we were to associate Mendoza with one of those sons, Disraeli or Montefiore, which one would we, you know, which bucket would we put them into? And while perhaps it's a little bit artificial to kind of say one of them has to be one, each of them, and obviously there's one that will be left over, I think it is at least a good kind of mental exercise in trying to kind of think about them in a more meaningful type of way. And that's really what I want to kind of come to the story of Mendoza, because, you know, of all of these individuals, you know, Montefiore and Disraeli, you know, I kind of first thought about Mendoza as kind of almost like, okay, he was famous, but, you know, in a certain sense, maybe he's the least interesting, you know, of all of these figures, you know, from kind of a historical, religious perspective. You know, the guy was a boxer. You know, like, you know, we don't normally think of it as, you know, like the great intellects, the great, you know, kind of leaders, you know, of the world, you know, in that way. You know, he's not a prime minister. He's not a philanthropist that, you know, created, you know, the foundations of the modern state of Israel. Like, you don't think of him, you know, in those kind of profoundly significant ways. And yet what I found from, you know, reading more about him over time and certainly in preparation for this class is that he's actually really interesting. And that we actually can learn a lot about identity and about the history of Anglo-Jewry, about the history of Britain through Daniel Mendoza. And that I find a lot of academics actually devote, you know, time to addressing Mendoza, not only people who are just kind of into sports history, but actually, you know, historians that are interested in nothing to do with sports history, actually find that Mendoza is a really important figure to think about. So in that way, it kind of, for me, helped me perhaps appreciate Daniel Mendoza in a broader, kind of more meaningful, significant way, and actually felt that he really does have a place within this lecture series, you know, in an informative capacity. And so that's really kind of the way I want to introduce this lecture tonight, is that Mendoza is an important historic figure for a variety of different reasons. And what I'd like to do tonight is to kind of reflect and talk about those different ways that he is an important historic figure, and, you know, and why is that the case. So let's just start with the basic biography of him. Of course, what he's most famous for is that he was a pugilist, which is a really cool word for boxer, and he's considered to have been, you know, kind of the boxing champion for some years in the 1790s. We'll talk a little bit about his boxing career later in the lecture, but just to kind of give a little bit of context, he was born in 1764 in this neighborhood, and he died in this neighborhood in 1836. So he lived into his 70s. Okay, so that's kind of to place him a little bit in history. Now let's place his ethnicity in context as well. Of course, we know he was a Jewish fellow. He had Jewish parents who were from here. His grandfather is actually famous in kind of the history of I don't quite know if I would say in rabbinics, but in kind of the Jewish history as well, because his grandfather translated an important work about ritual slaughter into Portuguese from Spanish, making that text available that goes through kind of the regulations of ritual slaughter. And there also, in his publication, includes pictures of ritual slaughter. So, you know, pictures of a guy lying next to a cow, cutting it open and pulling the innards out of it. So kind of like really interesting, give you a little bit of sense of kind of his background, right, that he comes from people who were, you know, presumably knowledgeable enough about Judaism that they could help, you know, put out that type of publication. And so, you know, he comes from a deeply kind of Jewish connected family, previously from Amsterdam, and then obviously previously from the Iberian Peninsula. What about the Jews themselves in England? So the Jews in England at that time, many of them were Sephardic Jews, which Mendoza's family was. And many of the more kind of famous ones were merchants, some extremely wealthy merchants, right? Wealthy enough that they could build this beautiful synagogue that would stand here for 300 years. And yet many of the Jews who lived in this part of London, this is where Jews lived, were quite poor. And there was a lot of poverty in this area, in the Sephardic community, and certainly within the Ashkenazic community. There was a lot of poverty. And what begins to develop during this time is there's also an increase in crime being committed by Jews. There's a famous case that takes place around this time of a burglary committed by Jews, and they actually murder somebody in the burglary, and this became kind of like a widely, kind of known case, and kind of raised this question of who are these Jews? They're poor. They're committing crime, right? And kind of this, kind of reputation that Jews were kind of becoming to be known by, right, in not very positive terms. And in a lot of ways, the Jews of that time, the term that historians will use is that they were tolerated, right? And that's really a good term because Jews' status in society really was toleration. From a legal perspective, it was toleration, right? Jews had never been formally readmitted into England. Even though Jews had at that point already been living here for a century, there never had been any kind of official kind of decision on exactly that Jews could live here after they'd been expelled in 1290. But essentially, Jews were here and they were tolerated and they kind of just existed in this way. But they weren't necessarily part of society, right? They weren't kind of in that sense, hey, let's go invite, that Jewish guy over for dinner, right? They didn't have that role within society, right? They were kind of seen as apart, as different, right? They weren't truly British because they were Jews, and to be British meant that you had to be Christian. And so in that sense, they weren't really seen as part of society. And in fact, in the years leading up to the story of Mendoza, there actually had been a bill put forward known as the Jew Bill in 1753 that actually didn't have... It wasn't such a radical bill. What it essentially was saying is that if you were foreign-born Jew who resettled here, that there would be a path for you to gain certain civil rights. If you were born here, you got those rights, right? So it was essentially trying to say that if you were wealthy, you were investing in the country, right, that you would get certain, rights that regular English people would get. It passed, but then there was such kind of this outpouring of anger, that what, we're letting Jews take over this country. I mean, it had nothing to do with what actually the bill stated, that it was repealed. And so, kind of after that moment of kind of this opportunity and then taken away, the late 1700s actually become a kind of uncomfortable time for Jews in England. And that's kind of brought out in kind of the society. Historians say that actually one of the kind of a popular pastime at this period would have been Jew baiting. And that was kind of just a thing that you did for kicks, was, go pick on Jews and things like that. And so it wasn't, in some ways, the kind of this illustrious, time in the history of Anglo-Jewry, which we know has had many wonderful moments, but this was maybe kind of a more difficult time within the history of Anglo-Jewry. Let's talk about British people now, right? Let's talk about what was going on in England at that time. And this question that's going on within England about British identity. And this is something that Brits are struggling with at that time, about what does it mean to be British, right? It's not familiar, right? What does it mean to be British? And one of the things that kind of is part of the kind of British self-identity is this idea of that to be British means that you are heroic and that you are tough, right? That was kind of, we can go into battle, we can defeat the Spanish, right? We can, right? That's kind of part of the this, what historians have kind of talk about, this kind of focus on masculinity, right? That's part of kind of this vision of what it means to be British, to be masculine, right? And particularly to be masculine and not French, right? And this kind of feeling that the French are a little bit more effeminate, right? And there's kind of like this, identity which is being crafted out of, what do you associate French people like as opposed to British people, right? And there's part of that which is playing into this. But there's also this question about kind of how does violence fit? Because you want to be tough, but you also, right, to be British also means to be civilized. So how do you, be tough and kind of you know, don't mess with me, but you also have this struggle about, but you want to be a civilized society, that believes in law and order and justice, right? And kind of this conflict between these different value systems and how exactly they go together. And that becomes a challenge that, you know, particularly the upper class of English society are trying to deal with, and how they're actually going to try to negotiate these kind of conflicting ideals within British identity. Now, surrounding all of those debates is a general debate which is going on in England surrounding boxing in general, and exactly the place of boxing. Because on the one hand, there is a concern, right, that boxing is, you know, so violent and it's like uncouth, right? And so you're not gonna, you know, you don't solve your problems by fighting with people, right? That's not how you resolve issues. On the other hand, there is this contrast kind of in the mentality about, you know, what is the kind of like French way of dealing with combat, right? That's fencing, right? So the French do fencing, but the British box, right? And kind of, again, this kind of contrast between kind of masculinity and what they saw as like kind of more effeminate, you know, kind of, you know, that's prancing around with these swords, right? And so again, this is kind of the way the British are kind of thinking about these different things. But on the other hand, actually seeing boxing as being particularly civil, because there's also debates going on about dueling with guns, right? And that if you have a fight with someone, how do you resolve your conflict? Well, you duel. And right, people are saying, well, that's barbaric, right? Because you could actually kill someone. You know what's really civil? You know, take it outside and solve your problems that way, right? You don't have to shoot each other. You get into a fight, you see who wins, problem solved, right? And everybody goes on with their lives, right? Literally with their lives, and, you know, and that's a great way to resolve things, right? So kind of all of these things are then going on around boxing about what its role is, and this debate is going on within society of, is boxing appropriate? Is it not appropriate? Is it violent? Is it not violent? Right? These are things that kind of British society is kind of fighting with at that time. But one of the things that becomes interesting is this question of, then boxing is theater, right? So people will like to go to the theater to see a show, right? And starting to have this idea of, well, maybe you go to see, right, people fighting, right, as a form of entertainment as well. Right, and now at that point, it's not, is it resolving disputes? Is it about just two people fighting with each other? Right, so all of these things are kind of in the public sphere, kind of being debated, and there's a lot that's going on. And right, any psychologist will tell you, right, it's probably not actually a debate about boxing. Right, it's about a lot of other issues, but it's kind of playing out through this debate about the place of boxing within English society. What's amazing about Mendoza is that he informs a lot of these debates. And he actually kind of, I don't want to say resolves, but certainly contributes a lot to the way that people will think about all of these questions about, you know, what does it mean to be British? What does it mean to be masculine? How does one deal with problems? What does it mean to be civil? What does it mean to be a society ruled by law, right? All those things will actually kind of come together with Mendoza, not just because he gets into the boxing ring and happens to be a Jew, but because of the way that he does all of these things. And so in that way, he becomes a really important figure. And like I said, he becomes interesting to historians that deal with a whole variety of issues during this time period, because he actually isn't just some boxer. He actually is a lot more than that. Any questions? Yes. You came late, so I don't know. Yeah.
It was about to be set off.
That's fine. I'm teasing. Yeah.
The Jew Bill.
Yes.
You mentioned that it was a plot for foreign-born Jews to get some of the same rights as
yes.
The English-born. But then you also said that it was really aimed at wealthy individuals. So was there some kind of discretion whereby the government would not have given those rights to the poorer Jews?
Well, no, it's more if you were a foreign-born person, you didn't necessarily have certain rights, right? Just because you were here, right? Yeah. So the point was that if you were born here, then you had those rights. The question was, if you were foreign-born, there could be ways for you to get those rights. So if you were a Christian, maybe there'd be, you know, one path, you know, Church of England, whatever. But if you're a Jew, what's your path? So one of the things you weren't born here. So one of the things they said is that if you're kind of contributing to society, right, and you're kind of doing all this major investment within the country, right, then that should potentially, right, that's what the bill said, that you should be given,
so
right,
conditional,
some of those.
Conditional.
Exactly. And they basically passed it, saying yes, right? And so people said, listen, this is good for society. If you're born here, you get this anyway. It's not like, you know, we're really dealing with the question of the place of Jews in society, right? And so the people who proposed it thought it was kind of like a non-issue, but it ended up becoming such like a, there were politics going on at that time, if you can imagine politics in this country, and it ended up being used as a, you know, as a way to, for other things, the parties to fight with each other. I mean, it was basically, the Jews were a casualty of other political issues that were going on. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about Daniel Mendoza, right? And we'll kind of see how, yes?
Sorry. It's a question.
Yeah.
You said before that the Jews are not seen as part of society, they wouldn't be invited over for dinner, and so on. And I'm just wondering, was this only solely due to the way in which non-Jews saw Jews, or was it mutual? Jews, you know, also sort of saw themselves as a different part of society. And
I think that's a good question. I'll just to repeat your question, right? He was saying, you know, was it only that kind of the Christian English saw Jews as other? You know, did the English Jews see the Christian English as other as well? So that's always that's always a hard question, but certainly the Jews are mimicking. I mean, they're doing a lot of acculturation, right? I mean, you can look around this room and see pictures of Chazanim with tri-corner hats, and the like. So Jews are certainly acculturating, right? They're definitely trying to kind of fit in with society. And I don't want to say that there were no interactions kind of on a social level at all, but it seems like that broadly speaking, there was kind of this anathema, you know, kind of going on, right? And then it's always hard to answer, right? Once you're not nice to me, then I look down at you as well, right, as a defense. So those things got to think a little bit tricky exactly how to answer that. But maybe with some of these things we'll bear them out. So let's just talk about his childhood. As I mentioned, Daniel Mendoza was born in this area. Family were members at Bevis Mark Synagogue. He went to the synagogue school, actually in principal of the head teacher of that school, even till today, Sha'arei Tikva, Gates of Hope, mimicked after the name of the congregation, which is Shar HaShemayim, right? Gates of Heaven. So Gates of Hope is the school of Gates of Heaven. And he grows up in this community and to a family that's, not wealthy. And, you know, at a certain point, he, you know, starts to, passes his age of bar mitzvah, which, of course, he celebrates here, the whatever way people celebrated bar mitzvah back then. But he grows up here. And then, you know, as he goes into kind of young adulthood, it's time for him to go work. And he works a whole variety of different jobs. He works oftentimes with merchants, you know, kind of as an assistant. So whether it's a tea merchant or a fruit merchant or, you know, all these different kinds of, you know, jobs. But each one, you know, doesn't last very long. And it seems that each one kind of ends with a fight, you know, where there's where something doesn't go well, where whether he feels like I think one of his first jobs, he says, you know, that the guy he's working for, he feels like the guy's son kind of is looking at him funny or giving him a hard time, and they get in a fight, and, well, he moves on from that job, right? Or he works for a Jewish lady who sells fruit, and someone's giving, you know, her a hard time, and he kind of, to defend her honor, right, gets in a fight, and, well, then it's time to move on from that job. And so kind of job after, you know, he has a memoir that he writes. He says in one of his positions, he turns out he's, you know, that he actually is acting as like a smuggler. He didn't realize that he was smuggling, of course. You know, he only realized afterwards that that's what he was actually being asked to do. In any case, he does a kind of a whole variety of these different jobs. Each one kind of ends in a similar kind of way. Until on one occasion, Again, he's being taunted, and well, he, I'll read to you what he writes for what exactly transpires in that case. Okay, so he writes the following. So this takes place in Northampton. So he says, this is what happened. Where he happened to meet a young man who was considered as the bully of the place, who observing two Jew lads, strangers to him, walking about and conversing together in different manners, thought proper to show them a little consequence of the occasion, and therefore accosted us, observing that he supposed, quote, we were after no good, that, quote, he hated to see such fellows strolling about the place, that, quote, it was a pity we were not sent to Jerusalem, and using many other expressions equally absurd and insolent. And using many other expressions equally absurd and insolent, I replied with some warmth, which provoked him further, and threatened to kick me out of town, I knew he placed great reliance upon his superior strength and size, and flattered himself with the idea of behaving as he pleased without meeting resistance, but that for my own part, I so feared him, or his threats, that boy as I was, I would fight him on the spot, if he chose for a guinea. So severely was he beaten that he could not walk home without assistance, and was afterwards confined to his room for upwards of 3 weeks. And so began his career. And so he seems to kind of gain a little bit of, you know, people are starting to talk about town, about this this guy who, you know, can, you know, defend himself against those of superior size and strength, and begins to develop a bit of a reputation. And he ends up being kind of tutored or mentored by a... another boxer who's well known, his name is Humphreys, and this Humphreys kind of takes him under his wing, and they kind of start studying together and teaching him, but eventually they have a falling out. What exactly happens is not entirely clear, but they end up having a falling out. Right in here, I'll just show you just some quick pictures. This is Mendoza as a young man. He's described as being kind of this good-looking, this dark hair, you know, long hair, and we'll see here. We'll get to him a little bit later. And so he ends up, you know, ultimately kind of like breaking out on his own. He's no longer going to kind of work with this other boxer. And he starts developing his own style. And he becomes known as not just, you know, just some other boxer, but that he actually has his own methodology, right? And it's expressed in this one of these famous portraits of him. Right, where you can see, I mean, to us, this picture might not look so strange. Okay, he's kind of in a special stance. But at that time, that's not the way boxers fought. Right, essentially, they just got in the match and went at each other. Now, boxing back then was not the way that it is now. Right, first of all, it's bare knuckle. Right, and it was a combination. There wasn't only just punching each other. There could have been other kinds of, you know, elements of like wrestling or whatever, other things that were kind of involved within the fighting, and basically you would just pummel each other, right, until one of you, right, couldn't get up any longer, okay? And Mendoza develops technique, right, where he actually stands in a particular way, and he uses his hands in a particular fashion in order to defend himself against the punches of whoever he is that are fighting. And in fact, he develops techniques about how you defend, how you block a punch, and how while you block with one hand, you block your stomach with another hand. And in fact, actually, to stand in a way where you actually almost are inviting the person that's fighting you to throw punches, knowing that if they keep throwing punches and you're just blocking their punches, they're going to get a lot more tired than you are. And once they're tired, then their defenses go down and you can take them out, right? And that he actually developed this capacity to defeat boxers that were superior to him in strength and size. He was, according to records, was 5'7", 160 pounds, right? Not a large, you know, picture, you know, kind of person by boxing standards, and he was able to take, to defeat boxers who were larger in size from him, right? He's what we would call today middleweight, not heavyweight, and yet he became the heavyweight champion, right? To just give you a sense of kind of at that moment in time that he was kind of superior in his technique, right? And that becomes his signature style. What ultimately ends up happening is there becomes confrontation between him and Humphreys. Now, in the meantime, he gets married to Esther, he starts having children, right? He is in the community, he's kind of raising a family, a Jewish family, right? There are people here who perhaps are descendants of his or of relatives of his, right? So he's carrying on, but he's also being a pugilist, right? Like, not the thing we think of when we think of Jews, right? He's kind of carrying on within this. But there ends up being this kind of taunting that begins back and forth between Humphreys and between Mendoza, where they finally decide they're going to have a match, and they meet in Odeum to have their first match. And the match carries out. The end result of the match is that Mendoza loses. Mendoza loses the match. He is defeated. And this is immortalized in several different ways. I'll show you one of the etchings that was made of it. Well, this is just showing actually his earlier matches, so showing you kind of the way the matches would have taken place on these kind of rude things, right? People are standing around, right? You can see they're all kind of gentlemanly type of figures, right? And that'll be something interesting to think about in thinking about the boxing, is the people who are attending are the aristocrats, right? Oftentimes there are royals who are in attendance at these different matches, right? And that's what's going on. So all of a sudden you have this, again, in thinking about British society, right, you have this kind of brute force type of thing taking place, but it's the aristocrats that are going to see those matches, right? And that's going to be playing out about this question of what does it mean to be British is going to play out in part within the ring. Okay, so this was a etching that was made to show the triumph, right, the triumph of Humphreys over Mendoza. Here you can see Humphreys up on over here, right? Here you can see Mendoza on the ground, of course being tended to by a rabbi-looking figure. Of course, that's the one who's taking care of the Jew, right, is the rabbi, right? And you can see, right, even this kind of hideous-looking figure, right? Kind of this, like, you know, like very kind of like caricature portraits of Jews, right? And here you have all these other figures who are kind of celebrating Humphreys' victory. But what's interesting, and this is where we'll kind of see a question, is that in this etching that was made of it, this was meant to show, well, maybe it wasn't a fair fight. And one of the things that's reported about the fight is that basically when you were boxing, you would have a second, right, who was kind of there to kind of back you up if something illegal happened, or if you, but basically the way boxing happened back then is if you fell down, that was the end of the round, right? And as long as you got back up, then you would start the next round, right? So some of these matches, they talk about they were, you know, they would go on, there were 55 rounds, you know, meaning it's not the way it is now where it was a time. If you got knocked down, the round ended, and the match would continue as long as you got back up, right? But what seems to happen, and this is what this is portraying, is that Mendoza was about to lay a blow to Humphreys, who was being weakened, and his second blocked his punch, right? And that after that, that's when then Humphreys was able to kind of regain his composure and was ultimately able to defeat Mendoza. But if Mendoza would have been able to land that punch, then he probably would have defeated Humphreys already, right? And that'll end up leading to them having a public debate, right, over social media at that time, right, through the papers, where they start kind of fighting with each other and saying, hey, you know, I can beat you, you're no good, right? I can't defeat you. And it ends up kind of leading to this question of, well, they should have a rematch, right? That will take place. But let me just read to you a poem. It's almost written as like one of these like heroic poems about that particular match. Okay, I'm going to read to you a few parts. It was called the Odeid, right? That's where it took place, right? But very much kind of this like Greek type of poem. And this is the following. I'll just read to you a few portions. And what's going to be important about it, and the one thing I want to bring out, is not only about the match, but it's about the way that Mendoza is portrayed. Okay, so look at the following. It says, now, the way boxing happened back then is that at this point, you didn't pay an entrance fee, but you bet on the match, right? That's how it worked. If you bet on the match, then you would be able to attend it. So he says the following. He says, now, bets urge bets at synagogue and change, right, the pun means change alley, and all the reverend rabbi round him range. With grinning joy, their puny David bless, and like their pristine prophets, bode success. Thus plumbed, thus trained, the second Shylock stood, but lost his gold, nor shed the expected blood. Right? So here, right, referring to him as Shylock. He lost. They lost all their gold, right? Because he's going to lose. So everyone's going to lose their bets. But he's surrounded by all his rabbis, right? All these Jews, right? They're all a bunch of rabbis. Okay. And then it says, Mendoza, mortal foe to Christian light, aims his left fist against the opponent's fight. Bold Humphreys totters, foiled in every thwack. Head, eyes, ears, nose, lips, teeth, loins, belly, back. Right? All smart alike beneath the ruthless Jew. Right? Who matches blow the astonished vulgar view. All Judah shouted while they spied below, prone and supine, the topsy-turvy foe. Right? So this part of the ballad, right, as we call it, the poem, right, is talking about how he is succeeding. Right? How he is succeeding at defeating the Christian. Okay. But then it continues, and it says the following. It says, a foul reverse of chance Mendoza found, and all Jerusalem lamented round. Mendoza's ear then felt a deadly blow, and tides of curdling gore began to flow. Each drum resounded, and defeat and pain, with thrilling abound, vibrate in his brain. Nor paused the fist, but quick the impetuous hit, with force electric, probed the stomach's pit. Down dropped the pallid Jew, and breathless sunk, and a battered mummy, an exhausted trunk. On wings of foe, the fable carrier flies, all ominous, the hovers in the skies. Duke's place, and Houndsditch, at the portent look, all the black-eyed daughters shrieked and shook. Right? Reference to all the Jewish girls there. Right? And so describing, you know, kind of, oh my gosh, the Jewish hero has fallen, and all the Jews are, you know, are aghast. So here you have this presentation, and what's fascinating about it, it's talking about the match, and it's talking that he succeeds, he falls, but the whole presentation of it is like the Jew versus the Christian. Right, he's not a boxer fighting another boxer. It's a Jew versus Christian, right? So it's being cast in this very religious light, and it shows you the sense to which he is a Jewish figure, right? He is very much a Jewish figure, and he will be referred to in different places in different ways, right? The press will often refer to him as Mendoza the Jew, while in other sources, right, depending if it's more laudatory, like later writings about him, will refer to him as the Star of David. Right, and so he's kind of being contrasted, right? Everyone's kind of like talking, not just like another guy fighting, but as a Jew who's fighting. And at that time, kind of think about the history, it's like such a bizarre picture for them because the Jew is the one you pick on the street, right? And there's this Jew that's fighting back, right? And but they see it very much in these kind of Christian Jewish terms. Okay, so that's that. They finally arrange for a rematch. Boxing is not completely legal. You're not allowed to just fight. They try to meet one place. The constable finds out they can't meet. Eventually, after some time, some of these are a year later, they finally meet again. And this time, Mendoza is triumphant, right? This time, Mendoza wins the match, right? That's what's portrayed in this particular image, right? You can see how muscular he looks, right? And he defeats Humphreys, which, of course, now they have to have a rubber match. Right? Because each of them has won one match. There has to be another match, right? That one fight happens in Stilton. They're going to have one more match, which is going to take place in Dorchester. Okay? And these things are written out in the papers. And again, they're kind of fighting with each other through the press, writing back and forth about what each one thinks about the other. And in the final match, once again, Mendoza is the figure, is the winner. And actually, in some of the reports about it, some of them actually described that there were times when Humphrey looked like he was going to lose, and, you know, Mendoza could have given the final punch, but he was merciless, and he didn't, you know, kind of take the final punch. He allowed Humphreys to kind of regain, and, you know, kind of describing, like, wow, like, look how magnanimous, you know, this Jew is. And so they're kind of, like, really interesting portrayals about him in all of these different contexts. But what becomes interesting about him, right, is that he doesn't just fight, But he writes about it, right? And he writes a book about the, called The Art of Boxing, where he develops, where he presents to people what he calls the science of it, right? Technique, right? That it's not just about two people getting up and just going at it, but actually there's a way to do it and there's technique and he develops it, right? And one of the things that he's doing is he's trying to make it, he's making it respectable, right? It's not just about two people fighting with each other, but there's a science to it, right? Just the same way you think of fencing, right? There's technique and there's style to it, right? So he's what they call like kind of the professionalization of the sport, right? There's going to be rules and there's going to be ways that you do it and there is tactic, right? All of a sudden, it's becoming a much more interesting type of sport than just a bunch of people pummeling at each other, right? Which historians talk about is kind of this this irony that's being played out because on the one hand, right, boxing is kind of considered British because it's kind of, it's very physical. And the thing they don't like about, you know, fencing is that, it, you know, it's all just kind of these, so everything's been very kind of sanitized. On the other hand, in order to make boxing have a place in society, they need to slightly sanitize it, right? So it's kind of the, in the same time that they're kind of allowing to be part of society, they're actually doing the thing to it, which in part takes away with what perhaps is what made it so British. But in any case, they're trying to find that fine line. And the fascinating thing about all of this is that who's the one that's, in a sense, enabling boxing to be part of British society, right? This thing that there's nothing more British than boxing, that's Jew, right? And there's kind of like this inherent irony or kind of contradiction within the whole enterprise that the whole point, that reason that British people love boxing is because it's considered so British. But the person who's allowing it to succeed is a Jew, who they don't consider to be British. So there's a lot of kind of contradiction, self-contradiction that's going on, you know, not necessarily even intentionally, but it's kind of, historians now in retrospect can see how these contradictions are playing out during that time. Okay, one of the things that he also does, and this is interesting, is he also opens up a school. So he opens up a training facility where he's going to train, you know, anybody that wants to learn it. He'll spar with other people there. He'll teach there. There is actually a location not far from here where the first school met. We're going to do a walking tour next month of Anglo-Jewry during the 17th and 18th century. And I've planned out the tour that will hopefully will stop at the location of where his school had met during that time. And, you know, he's kind of really presenting it and developing in this really interesting way, right? Where boxing isn't just something you do because you're a tough guy, but actually it's something you can teach other people and other people can learn and there'll be kind of high society people that will come to learn how to, you know, the art of self-defense at his schools, right? And it kind of becomes this like really interesting kind of development within the history of boxing and its place within society, right? And it's not the way we only think of it today, which is, you know, boxing is just kind of these, you know, spectacles and whatever, but it's like part of like the way that British people are preserving their toughness, right? That you're going to learn how to take care of yourself, you're going to learn how to fight, right? So it's not just about, you know, the actual match, right? But it's about the self-development and physical health and the ability to defend yourself. And if British people should ever be called upon again to fight, that they will be prepared to do that. And certainly with the rise of Napoleon, that's going to become very much a part of kind of the culture in this country, is that we have to, right, our young men have to be able to go to battle when called to do that, right? And so this is all kind of playing out together within what's going on in society. What's interesting is that, you know, as a result of all this, he really becomes a phenomenon. He becomes known throughout. He'll go on tour, he'll go to Ireland, he'll go to different places where he'll actually kind of teach his school, teach his methods, and so on. He becomes incredibly popular. He's writing in papers, he's published a book, right? He's really become this big figure, and according to reports, I haven't seen like any actual evidence of this, apparently he's the first Jew to be invited to have an audience with King George III. Which, you know, kind of becomes part of this whole mystique, right? He's like, you know, the first person to have a royal audience is a boxer, is this Jewish boxer. So again, so in terms of kind of his, you know, what he means, you know, kind of his place in English society, but obviously what he means to Jews, right, is really becoming quite popular. In fact, there are all this kind of memorabilia that come out surrounding him as well. So here you can see a mug
which is cast, right? The Humphrey and Mendoza fighting at Odeon, right? So this is from the first fight, right? So that's a mug. So there are all these kind of different, you know, things you could purchase that had Mendoza on it, right? And in a lot of ways, he really comes as the first figure. In fact, the third fight that they have, the rubber match, is apparently the first boxing match where they sold tickets, right? That you could actually buy a ticket to see it, right? So it really begins kind of like the first kind of like public sporting events, right? It wasn't just about the gambling, but it was also how you could pay to watch it, right? And so the organizers can make money from that, or the boxers can make money just from the sales of the tickets. So it really is kind of what they call like this professionalization of it, the development of sports. He's the first sports superstar in a lot of ways, right? So he's a really interesting in all those different ways. So let's just talk a little bit. For those, anybody have any questions?
Yeah, the second picture of the rematch.
Yeah.
The title of the picture, one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's called Foul Play. So that indicates something went wrong in that one as well.
Yeah, so again, within each of these things, there's going to end up being these like kind of debates of, you know, should he not have thrown another punch? Was it already too late? Right, so with each of these things, right, and what seems is like, you know, when they draw these pictures, right, they want to, right, I mean, he's trying to present in each of these pictures, right, something that, you know, something wasn't fair there either, right, so that wasn't fair, and that match wasn't fair, then there has to be another match which can be fair, right, like, it has to, and they end up, again, they use the newspapers to write, kind of like, to make barbs against each other, so there seems to be a lot of showmanship that's also going on with this, right? They potentially make money from these fights, right? And there seems to be, it's theater. It's also theater, right? It's not just a fight, right? And theater is kind of popular at that time. And one of the things that you find, there's going to be, later in his life, there's going to be a big debate going on in England about forms of entertainment. And a lot of people who are very opposed to the introduction of Italian opera, right? And they say that that's like ruining England, right? That's so like not British, right? And so, you know, we have to bring back, you know, the other forms of entertainment. So this is, you know, theater, right? This is English theater in part at that time as well. And it's kind of all part of this kind of public spectacle of the whole enterprise. Yeah.
As he becomes more famous, does he maintain his relationship with the Jewish community? Does he broaden his horizons? And also, what's his level of religious observance?
Good. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about that, yeah. So let's talk about his contributions, right? So he introduces the science of boxing, right? That's kind of way, right? The science, right? That it's not just two people fighting. There's actually tactic involved in that. It kind of becomes the British fencing, right? It becomes this kind of this is the way British people, you know, kind of engage in you know, respectable combat, right? And the idea is that he brings in a sense a level of respectability to the sport when there is a lot of public debate about it. Right, and that's where partly kind of becomes this interesting thing that, right, the aristocrats can come to the match, right, and it's respectable, you can come, but right, so it's like the aristocrats' way of kind of maybe getting in touch with their own masculinity, right, because they're not getting in these types of fights, but at least they can go to these fights and support these fights, and so it's like their way of kind of connecting with that, right? There's a lot of kind of cultural stuff that's going on, so he plays a really important role in kind of putting it into that particular place. He also becomes known as the father of the Jewish school of boxing, right? So when you start having, let's say, the 1820s, 1830s, you'll start having people kind of writing in retrospect about boxing. They'll actually talk about that there were different schools of boxing, maybe different styles and so on. And Mendoza is the father of the Jewish school. And he actually will be kind of the mentor to a whole kind of like generation of Jewish boxers, Dutch Sam, and some of these other fellows, right, who become known as these Jewish boxers. It actually creates like a whole generation of Jewish boxers, right? And it becomes like a thing that like Jews are known as boxers, right? It's like part of like the identity of Jews in England at that time that like they're famous for being boxers, right? So that becomes like this really interesting thing which we'll reflect on as well, but he's kind of the father of that movement, right? You can imagine, right? He's this successful boxer. He's in this poor neighborhood, right? There's these other little Jewish boys who you'd be like, you know, I want to go to Mendoza school. I want to learn to fight like him, right? And that's kind of what's, you know, happening, you know, within this. And so there'll be a whole kind of like generation of kids that are going to grow up kind of looking up to Mendoza and learning from him, who will then go on to fight as well, to the point that, you know, it's like one of the things, when you think of boxers in England, you think like, oh, that's like things that Jews do, right? That's kind of like part of like what who boxers are during that time. Now, one of the things that he also does is this idea of kind of creating a public Jewish identity, right? And he's going to, like I said, publish books. He's going to write a memoir as well, right? And so you, for the first time, you have a Jew who's like really well known, right? It's not just, oh, those Jews who are these kind of like faceless, nameless, you know, inhabitants of that part of London, right? But actually, it's a person who you know, right? Who you recognize, right? Who you've heard about, who's celebrated, right? So all of a sudden, you have this really kind of public profile for a Jewish person, for, you know, this like kind of like real great success. And that's going to be really kind of important about, you know, kind of the place that it's going to have. And what it does is it seems to create Jewish pride. And we can see from the poems that it seems that at his matches, a lot of Jews would attend his particular matches. And it seems to develop this idea of Jewish respectability. Right? We'll see, I'm going to share a quote a little bit later about that, right? But this idea that Jews are tough also, right? So you don't just pick on Jews anymore, right? And so he ends up doing a lot for the Jewish community in that way from his fighting, right? That he kind of changes the attitude or the kind of the image of the Jew, right? The Jew isn't just this kind of dirty, poor criminal, right? But he actually is, right, someone that you don't mess with, right? And so that's kind of like this really interesting kind of contribution that he makes. But again, he's also famous, right? So he's also not just a tough guy, but it's also like, wow, like, Jews can be cool also, right? You know, so it's really interesting what he almost single-handedly, or maybe two-handedly, right, accomplishes for the place of Anglo-Jews in British society. So let me, did any questions on that? Fine. So I want to just, this is going to be the last kind of section I want to focus on, right, is this question of his Jewish identity, right? Because I think that also plays an important question. So the question of, you know, what did his Jewish identity mean? So first of all, he retained Jewish identity throughout his life. He will publish a memoir. In his memoir, he will talk about his childhood. He will talk about Purim in his memoir, about the time that they dressed up, and they actually dressed up as sailors, and people confused them with sailors, and they ended up getting kind of like arrested because they were, and then they got out, and they went, and they performed, and he wasn't very good at singing, but he sang anyway because he didn't care. And like it's kind of like really funny story. He talked about that he was really good at making these little kind of like Passover cakes. I don't know if it, actual cakes or if that means matzot, right? But then he kind of like, you know, he's a Jewish guy, grew up in the East End, you know, and he's Jewish, you know, he grows up in a Jewish family, you know, he's very conversant and comfortable with that. And he'll often kind of talk about his Jewishness, and he quotes in his memoirs, you know, things that were said about him, about his being Jewish. And, you know, while it doesn't, in his memoir play, you know, when he's talking about the matches, it's just, you know, he's just talking about matches, but it ends up, you know, it's part of his identity, and it's part of his mystique, and it's the way that he's known, right? And you can see from all these things, like, he's never just a boxer. He's the Jewish boxer, right? So it is part of his identity. He never moves away from it. And I think that's something really important to think about. Now, in terms of his, what we might call halachic observance, so that's an interesting question. I actually had opened up a file here, but unfortunately the computer closed on me, so I don't have it open now. But I was interested about that. You know, was he Shomer Shabbat? You know, what exactly? So we know that his I was in touch with a historian who wrote a book about him, who sent me the ad that was in the paper for his boxing school. And it shows all the dates and times, and it was open on Saturdays, right? So it was open on Saturdays. So I was thinking about it, right? You had to, presumably had to pay an entrance of a shilling to get in. Maybe he didn't collect the money, right? Someone else collected it. Now, I thought it was interesting. The time that it was open was at 12:30. So, I don't know. We tend to end here at 11:30 and then have Kiddush. So, like, you know, maybe it was like, you know, it was like perfect time. You know, you come to the Bevis Marxer services, you have your bridge roll, right? And then you go watch Mendoza. I mean, he came to synagogue first. We don't really know about. But he didn't have his match, you know, his ring open on Shabbat. You know, we don't. You know, it's not. But I think that in and of itself is interesting to think about because, you know, then if you think about it, is that he is this Jewish person. He's proudly Jewish. He's brought respectability to Jews. He's raised up a generation of Jews who can defend themselves. He's very proud, very public, very kind of, you know, I wouldn't say outspoken, but he's very kind of clear about his Judaism. And yet he may not follow, you know, all the laws, but he's a Jew, right? He is a Jew. And I think that's what makes him, to me, a really interesting figure in kind of thinking about him as a Jew and one of those paradigms of Anglo-Jewry, right? Because he is this Anglo-Jew that says that, you know, he may not be the most pious of Jews, or I don't think of the piety of Jews getting into fistfights, right? We don't think that, you know, the pious Jew has their store open on Shabbat. But he is a Jew, and he's a proud Jew, and he's a member of the Jewish community, and I don't see any evidence that he was not completely welcomed at Bevis Marks Synagogue, right? And this kind of recognition that, listen, people are more observant or less observant than each other, but it doesn't matter. You're still part of the Jewish community. You're still part of Bevis Marks Synagogue, and it doesn't make a difference what exactly your halachic, you know, your legal observance is. You're a Jew. You identify as a Jew. Then you come to the Jewish synagogue. And, you know, beginning and end of the story, right? And I think that's like a really important kind of model of the Anglo-Jew, right? Which is that perhaps the individual Anglo-Jew fashions for themselves what their kind of personal religious observance is, but it has no impact in terms of their place within the Jewish community, right? And regardless of what your personal observance is, you have as much a place in the Jewish community, as much a place in Bevis Marks as any other Jew, right? And that's like a really, I think, that's unique in the Jewish world at that time, right? Jews here have that possibility because the Jewish community is not a state within a state the way it is in other countries, right? There is no Jewish state, right? There is a congregation. You pay your dues to the congregation. If you don't want to be a member of Bevis Marks Synagogue, you don't have to be Bevis Marks Synagogue. But you know what? You don't have to be Church of England. You can be part of nothing, right? It's up to you. So it's really, there's a lot more kind of individual autonomy in people determining for themselves who they want to be, right, and their place. And they're welcomed in the community regardless of what their personal choices are, right? And I think in that way, he is a paradigm of the Anglo-Jew, right? It's the Anglo-Jew that says, I can define what my Judaism is going to look like, but regardless of what it looks like, I am still a proud Jew, right? And I can still be part of the Jewish community beyond any question, right? And he will get married in Bevis Marks. He will get buried in the Novo Cemetery, which is on Mile End Road, which is now hidden behind Queen Mary University, right? He is fully part of the Jewish community, regardless of whether everything he does is considered to be the most Jewish activity. And again, I'm not, without making any judgments on any of these people, right, that we're going to be talking about, right, he represents definitely one of the paths of Anglo-Jews, and he was part of the community. And I think that's like a really interesting, really kind of important, because it's not just him, right? He reflects, I think, a type of Anglo-Jew, and that way is really important. Now, which of the four sons is he? Oh. So I want to place him as the Tom. Now, why the Tom? So the Tom, because the Tom is often associated, that term is used in reference to one of the biblical characters. You know, which biblical character is referred to as a Tom?
Jacob.
Now, Jacob is famous for what is he famous for?
Wrestling
with the angel, wrestling with Esau. So what better character to identify with Mr. Mendoza than Jacob, right? The Ish Tom, right? Right? Tom is often translated as the... this keeps opening different things, right? Right? The Tom is often kind of addresses the simple son, which in a certain sense perhaps Mendoza is, right? We don't think of him as a scholar, but we don't think of him as the ignoramus, right? He's comfortable in the Jewish community. He's the simple Jew. He's a Jew. He loves being Jewish. He's proud of being Jewish. He contributes to the Jewish community. He's part of the Jewish community. okay, he's not the greatest scholar in the world. You know, he's not the perfect. You know, he's not going to become the rabbi, right? But like, you know, but he's a good Jew. We like him, right? And in that ways, you know, I think of him. He's the Tom. You know, he's the Tom. He's the simple son. He is like Jacob. He is the wrestler. You know, what will actually happen, you know, in talking about his life, his final battle, he'll lose, and that's when he's going to retire for the most part. And in that battle, he's actually grabbed by his hair. He's known for having this, like, lush black hair. He's grabbed by his hair, and the guy just pummels him because he can't get out of it. And he just pummeled. The match is over 9 rounds. It's like 10 minutes, and it's over. And after, there was no rule that you couldn't grab him there, and it's after that that boxers shave their hair. Right, that becomes like, you know, a thing where it's like, don't give them something to hold on to. Right, that's like that rule hadn't yet been put in place. Right, boxing was still kind of in its infancy at that time. He will his later life will actually be poor. You know, kind of he takes odd jobs. So actually, when he's older, kind of have a match when he's like 50 years old. It's like 2 50-year-olds like fighting a match. Apparently, it's not like the most pleasant match to watch, right? You know, it's kind of like he's just trying to find a way to make some more money. You know, he publishes memoirs and whatever. You know, his book on the art of boxing. You know, he dies poor. You know, he dies poor. You know, off of what's it called, Petticoat Lane. You know, is where he lives. You know, his wife is destitute. There's a collection among the Boxer Association trying to raise money for his widow. But he becomes, I think, in that sense, a really important figure for Anglo-Jewry. I want to just do one final quote here. This is written in a magazine called Blackwoods at that time. This is written in 1817, about him. Okay, and it writes the following. It says, it declares the following. It says that the idea of a Jew, which our pious ancestors contemplated with such horror, has nothing in it now revolting. Right, and it's kind of this take. I'll just read that one more time. It says the idea of the Jew, which our pious ancestors contemplated with such horror, has nothing in it now revolting. Right. And it's like this moment where, like, he's brought, I mean, the irony is we think of boxing as, like, you know, this kind of, like, uncouth type of activity, but it brings respectability to the Jew. And other historians write that after this time, you don't find people picking on Jews as much. They know the Jews can defend themselves. And apparently, again, in the late 1700s, it wasn't uncommon if someone picked on a Jew and a police officer was standing there, he would just let it go, right? And after this time, you know, the officers would step in, you know, that would, you know, I mean, that's what the law was, but they actually would step in, right? There was just kind of that, it was no longer socially acceptable to push around Jews anymore. And that's really a result of Mendoza. And so he does, you know, again, we don't say want to raise our children to, you know, you don't say think, oh, I'm going to raise my kid to be a boxer, to, you know, have his store open on Shabbat or whatever, but we're proud of him. You know, we're proud that he, throughout his life, retained an identity as a Jew, retained part of the Jewish community, brought respectability to Jews, contributed to British society, you know, helped define what it means to be masculine, right, what it means to be a hero within British culture. And so in that way, he really becomes, you know, this paradigmatic British Jew, right, this British Jew that is proudly Jewish, but is proudly British, is able to contribute to both societies, and doesn't see it as one or the other, but in fact that you can be proudly both. In that sense, he's a really important figure. And, you know, it's kind of, you know, what I started with, of kind of thinking of like, you know, he's famous and he was a Jew, you know, I don't know how interesting he is. He's actually a really interesting character, right? He's really, I think, a really important historic figure, both for British history and for Jewish history, as well as those two histories together. And I think in that sense, he's such a great figure to think, you know, after this, I wanted to start buy some Mendoza memorabilia myself. You know, if you want to like try to like find one of those mugs on eBay, it's like £20,000. I mean, like, you know, the prints you can maybe get for like £1,000 or something like that. You know, so if anyone wants to get me a gift, please feel welcome. It's really cool. So in any case, so yeah, I think he's a figure in British Jewish history, which you know, it should be celebrated. Not in the way that I think people normally celebrate him. It's just, oh, you know, he's famous and a Jew. But I think he actually is a really important figure in the annals of Jewish history. He went to synagogue here. So if anybody wants to kind of get in touch with their inner Daniel Mendoza, I suggest that you come to Bevis Marks Synagogue for services, and you'll be most welcome. I'll just add just kind of, you know, that's what I think so much fun about this series is actually thinking like, you know, all these people went here. All these people came to the synagogue, and the synagogue is still here, and it's still running. It's the same synagogue. If they were to walk in, my expectation is that they would feel right at home. We have the same melodies, you know, many of the same melodies, the same customs, traditions, the culture, you know, the ethos. You know, maybe, I don't know what they would think of my top hat. They may be wondering, where's my tricorner? But like, you know, but besides for that, they would really feel at home. And I think there's that amazing thing when you can come and pray at Bevis Marks, you know, and you can actually kind of, you know, kind of touch it. You know, what was the culture? What was the kind of the atmosphere that inspired these figures, right? And we can be inspired by that same culture as well. So, you know, I hope if anything you take from this lecture, you know, a sense of trying to get in touch more with the world of Mendoza, which you can do, you know, here on every weekday morning and every Shabbat. If anyone's interested, we're actually going to do the afternoon service now. So anybody that would like to attend, you're welcome to actually come to, we'll have the synagogue open for you now. You're welcome to attend the services. I'm very happy for you to enjoy that. Does anybody have any questions? Yeah.
Are any of his descendants still members here of the congregation?
Is anybody here a direct descendant of his? Yes. Yes. Are any of you a member here?
No, unfortunately, we're not Jewish.
You're not Jewish.
We descend from Sophia, who's kind of the daughter who's a bit...
So one of his daughters ended up marrying a non-Jewish man.
Yes.
Is that?
Yeah, Ebenezer Jones.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Fine. So it didn't, right? But other of his family did remain Jewish. I know we have people who are descendants of either his siblings or his uncles and things like that. So if you guys are not members yet, please speak to me afterwards about membership. We should you should definitely keep that going strong. But yeah, apparently there's like thousands and thousands of like people in England that claim descendants, right? He had a lot of kids, so, you know. Yeah.
The other thing, I just wanted to know how many people really know where Daniel Mendoza's buried now.
So, yes. So
you know that story.
Yeah, so do you,